two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, I had a very fun conversation with Lisa Valentine Clark from The Lisa Show on BYU Radio. She's a writer, an actress, a comedian, and a radio show host. She recently lost her husband to ALS, and we just had a very fun and meaningful conversation. Let's get proximate. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. I met a new friend just today, and I've been a fan from afar, and I've been listening to some podcasts on BYU and BYU Radio. Here in the studio today, Lisa Clark. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am a little intimidated because you are the pro.
Whatever. So. I'm with the First Lady. How do you think I feel? Think about me.
First Ladies just make it up. So
I love it.
Here we go. No, I'm really excited. You are incredibly talented and just so much fun.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit. You know, your background, you are a writer, an author. You are an actress, a comedian, which I think is just so fascinating because, you know, everybody thinks they're funny, but
right?
No. There's only a few that really are. So, you know, we love comedians and we love to laugh. And Spencer and I have these. Tell me about your family a little bit, because when you're there's different humor in different families. Like there's like the true family,
right,
which is mine. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, and then totally.
And our family was like more slapstick and like goofy humor. And then Spencer's family is like all like sarcasm and kind of clever humor, like witty humor. Mm-hmm. You have to be a little smarter. We weren't.
So. That's awesome.
So what is your family? Where did you learn humor, or how did you learn humor?
So my family of origin, the Valentines, we grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, the Midwest. And my dad is really funny. And, you know, dinner time was a great time for us just to try to make each other laugh. And what's great, I'm one of five kids. As adults, we're all still very close and close with the in-laws and everything. It's really great, mostly, I think, because of our humor. And if I could make my brothers and sisters laugh, well, then, or my parents, that was like gold. And they didn't just hand it over to you, right? Like they made you work for it. And if it wasn't funny, they would let you know. So that's how I grew up, sort of doing that. And then, you know, in a school and junior high and high school and stuff, there was always, you know, opportunities to MC the talent show or the synchronized swimming show, and that whatever show got you to do like little sketches and skits in between the performance, I would want to do and just sign up with my friends and just try to be fun.
So were your parents in acting, or I mean, what inspired you to sort of, first of all, have the confidence? Because I think about myself, and in middle school, it's like, just don't be noticed, just don't be noticed.
Right.
How did you have the confidence to sort of say, yeah, I want to be in front of a crowd. I want to be making people laugh. What inspired you that way?
I don't think that I really thought of it that consciously. I remember in junior high, seeing a swing choir that would sing and dance. And I remember thinking, I'm going to do that one day. And I tell my kids, they don't believe me. but I'm going on the record and I'm saying it. It was cool. It was cool to do swing choir. I did it all through junior high and high school. It was so fun, but it got me doing performance after performance after performance, a ton of performances. And so I got over stage fright and things like that because we performed so many times. But for the whole humor thing, whether it was like a musical or a play or sketches and that kind of stuff, it was just being goofy with my friends. You know, like I just got to a point where I was like, I know I'm not cool and I don't care because we're just too much busy having too much fun. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I think I credit like who I hung out with. I would always want to hang out with the funny people, and I found them and I have no regrets. And so I think that really built it up. Then when I went to college and, you know, I was looking for the funny people, you know, the people who would just make me laugh and didn't take life so seriously. And they were said, hey, come and do this improv thing. And I'd never heard of that. And I started doing improv and then auditioned for the Garen's comedy troupe, which wrote, you know, and performed sketches as well as improvisational comedy. I was like, oh, I found my thing. I found my people. And yeah. I've never stopped doing it. I thought it was going to be a side thing. And no one's more surprised than me that it's actually turned out to be my main thing.
Do you? So is that kind of where I mean, I know Studio C.
Uh-huh.
Is that kind of where that started?
So if we can go way back.
Yeah.
Garen's Comedy Troupe was a club, right, at BYU,
okay,
where I went to college. And, you know, we had sold out shows every, you know, Friday, and it was so much fun. And we did that. There was another comedy troupe that started. One of my friends, actually, Randy Davis, started Divine Comedy with a bunch of friends. And he jokes with me, and I don't know if I can go on the record. I don't know if this is controversial or not. But he says, I started Divine Comedy because I didn't get into the Garrets.
Oh.
Now, I love to say that, but I don't think that's true. But Divine Comedy did the same thing. Did sketches and I don't think that they did improv and improvisational games, but out of that came Studio C.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's fully scripted. In fact, a good friend of mine that I do a lot of improv with and have done for decades is now the showrunner of that show. And
okay,
they're doing like awesome, fun stuff.
Well, it was just so different and people just loved it. And I mean, I remember the first time I watched the sketch years and years ago when it first came on. And I remember watching it thinking, what is this?
Yeah, you can't really
I was trying
like,
to figure
it.
Out, like, is this, because it's on BYU TV and I'm thinking, is this funny? I was trying to, like, oh yeah, it is. And then, like, my daughter, I got to a point with her and she was, I don't know, kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And I was like, okay, this is the rule. You cannot tell me line by line what happened in Studio C. That's just the rule. I will watch it with you, but I will not.
Right.
That's the rule. That and you can't explain a
whole. If you have to explain it.
Yeah, a whole episode of Phineas Ferb.
Oh,
no.
That's funny.
Because she's a stalker. It's like, that was
she knows
the rules.
What she likes. She's got good taste.
She does. So it was really fun. So let's go back to your family of origin. So there are five kids. Mm-hmm. And you grew up in the Midwest. What was that like?
It was great. It was great. I had a great childhood. You know, I had just great supportive parents. I grew up in a great neighborhood, and it got to a point where I think, you know, my parents were like, well, we could kind of live anywhere because of our work. And they just chose there to live there because it was like good air quality and great public schools. And I am really grateful for that. That we grew up there. I think people are really down to earth. I think that really helped to form. I didn't really feel like some of the kind of pressures that my kids felt. And I don't know if that's generational or geographical. I'm sure it's a combination of both, right? But yeah. Just great childhood, great siblings. And I'm lucky that I live near a couple of them, and then a couple of them sort of live far away, unfortunately. But we get together when we can, and thanks to technology, we're able to still make running jokes continue.
Oh, that's so fun. We love it too. I have eight sisters, so the sister thing, you know, two brothers, but the sisters, we think we're really funny.
Right. And that's all that's important, right?
We are hilarious.
No one else will get this, but look at this. And I know it's going to kill, you know, for all my brothers and sisters and what won't.
That's exactly right.
The fine tuning it for years and years. Yes. And that is the gift that I am to my family.
Yes. You're welcome. So then you came out to BYU mm-hmm. to go to school. And got involved in all that stuff. Yeah. And then did you meet your husband at
I did.
BYU?
I was studying to be a high school English teacher, which I was for a little bit. Talk about comedy training. Holy cow.
Thank you for being an educator for a minute.
I met my late husband when we were both English majors. He had just finished serving an LDS mission in Finland. He came back. He was on an acting scholarship, but decided to study English because it was more practical. We laugh about, I mean, I can't even get that sentence out. We were like, this is so practical. We're both going to be English majors. This is so great. We're so dumb. Anyway, so, listen, I'm trying to parent differently and be like, somebody has got to go into technology. I don't know.
I know.
STEM. And I don't know what everything STEM stands for, but like kids, everybody take one of the letters and they have not complied. Like, you would expect. But we were both in an English Society play together. You know, the English Society, the club, we were going to put on a play called Mysteries Creation, where we did scenes from the Bible.
Wait,
it was a real knee slapper.
So this is English majors deciding
on a play.
They're going to be
it's
actors.
It's as horrible as you think it is.
Okay.
But
just trying to get that right.
Was on acting scholarship, so he was the star, and he got cast as Satan, the most coveted role. I, on the other hand, got cast as a chicken on Noah's Ark. True story. But don't feel bad for me, because I did get promoted because they saw how committed I was to being a chicken. True story. I got to also be the dove on Noah's Ark, which I don't want to brag is a major part, because
it's
I
a
go
critical
and get the
role.
Olive branch and bring it back.
It's a critical role.
So that was the perfect environment for two misfit actors who are English teachers to be more practical to fall in love. Eventually, after they were friends for a year.
So you were friends for a year, and then you started dating, and
yes.
Then what?
A lot of things, like, you know, got
yada,
in the way.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yada, yada, yada. And then we got married. Ta-da!
You can't yada, yada. Okay.
Yep.
See, we're the same age. We have the same pop culture references.
Yep. Thank you, Seinfeld.
I'm probably older than you. I shouldn't assume we're the same age.
I think we're contemporaries.
So then you're married. Did you? And then you said you did. Did you both graduate in English?
Yeah. So we both graduated in English, you know, there were talks of Christopher going to law school, which I think is the funniest. That's the funniest joke now, you know, to be practical. But he went on to do other things, as did I.
Okay.
Yeah, we just changed our mind and we were like, you know what? We know who we are. Let's just go for it and do what it is that we really want to do. And so we both were able to do that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's just
really
fun.
My husband did go to law school, and I think he was always hoping he would be an actor instead.
Oh, it's not too late.
I know.
You know?
That's true. There's still room for...
Right.
We could jump out at any moment now.
Anytime. We'll put on a production. Let's put on a show.
Can you imagine?
Wouldn't that be the funniest thing, though?
That would be... He loves it. We do this fundraiser for the Shakespeare Festival every year.
Oh, that's awesome.
And this year they did Every Brilliant Thing, and they asked him to come in and do... you know, just like it's a little bit improv-y, but he said, you know, they said, you're going to be a dad and just do dad things.
Oh.
And so it turns out, you know, they were getting married and he was sort of giving them a congratulations speech. Oh. And everybody was dying. It was hilarious because he was making fun of me. So that's usually
thank
the
you.
Way it goes.
He was honored.
And everyone's like,
comedy.
Where did this come from? And I'm like, I provide
I
great material. That's. That's what I do. That's what I'm
here
for.
That's what you get after years and years of marriage. Come on. Right. That's awesome.
So
amazing.
So you married, you were a teacher for how long?
Yeah, for a hot minute. I taught junior high and high school English for a little while, and then I started having a lot of children and loved that. And while I was staying home with them, I taught and created online. This is back in when this was brand new.
Yeah.
And classes started going online, and I started creating curriculum and teaching online to keep up with the busy demands that I had at home, which were eventually 5 babies. So
wow, yeah. Wow. So and they're all used. I think you said 5 babies in 10 years.
Yeah, in 10 years.
So mm-hmm. every 2 year plan.
Loved it. Yeah,
that's
it
fantastic. Awesome. Boys, girls.
I have two sons and a non-binary child and 2 daughters.
Oh, that's amazing.
So it's great.
That's so fantastic. And how old's your baby?
She's 14.
Oh, okay.
So my oldest is 24 this week, and my youngest is 14.
We are very close.
Really?
I got her 23 and 15.
Oh, there you go.
So we are very close. Well, we want to get into some of the other things that you're doing and just some... We just want to keep going talking about your incredible life, and we'll do that when we come right back.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
We are back here on First Lady and Friends with the one and only Lisa Clark from The Lisa Show. I mean, you have a show that's your name, so
I know,
come on.
I always have to explain, I didn't pick the show, right? Like the name, right? You know, I was like, how about we do the morning thing? Or, hey, breakdown, like, because I could have a breakdown at any moment. I thought that was a funny thing. And they were like, no, let's call it The Lisa Show. So, yes, that's what it's called.
I love it. I love it. So you finished being a teacher at some point. You were being a mom for how many years? You were
forever.
I mean,
no, I know what you mean. No, I stayed.
You are
at home
still a mom.
Yes, yeah. Primarily was teaching online, and then I just always hustled, you know, and just did creative things. The great thing about doing the comedy troupe in college was a lot of those guys were writers and in advertising and things. And so I'd get calls like, hey, I wrote this commercial. Do you want to come and audition for it? Or we want to do this movie and we've got a part for you. Like, and so that just snowballed into just lots of different little projects, little indie movies here and there, commercials, voiceover work, and it just kind of grew and grew until it became full time.
Yeah. And so talk a little bit. I think on your show, I was listening to one of your episodes and you were talking a little bit about how you sort of snuck out at night to keep using
yeah.
your creativity and your skills. When you were, you know, you're balancing mom life and trying to still create, which I think is
well,
cool.
Yeah, I really do feel like being a mom, and this was really modeled by my own mother, is just like the most creative thing and creating that kind of family. So Christopher and I had this philosophy of like, yeah, we want to have this kind of home and this kind of kids and family life that we like, you know, and it might look different than other families, but that's okay. And he was really busy working full time and going to school full time. He got a master's in staging Shakespeare in England over at Exeter, and then a PhD in education and leadership and theater combined from BYU. And I was working and doing Once I Was a Beehive and hosting Random Acts and show offs. And so we, you know, it was highly scheduled, right? We had to schedule things. Everything was scheduled. And I really wanted to be there for my kids as much as I could, too, especially when they're little. But everybody needs a creative outlet. You know, everybody's got to have their thing. And I would always say it's kind of funny because, you know, for some women, like, you know, a generation ago, it would have been like scrapbooking or having a book club or bunco or, you know, which is totally great. But for me, it was going to do improv with my friends. So I'd tuck my kids in bed and sneak out and go down to the Velour in downtown Provo, which is a music venue that was just starting up at the time. And Corey Fox, who's just this, you know, the owner, such a great guy, was like, hey, listen, nothing's going on a Monday night. You guys can come and do improv there. And so we did shows there and just really created something that I am one of the things that I'm the most proud of, which is the Thrillionaire's long form improvisational group where we, a core group of us, would study a different genre or style every week and then come and have the costumes and the background and the themes of the entire play, an entire musical with original songs, you know, completely made up that night based on a genre. So it could be something like a John Hughes 80s movie or Shakespeare or a Western or a sci-fi movie or Oscar Wilde or Tennessee Williams or Jane Austen. And it would, we'd just get as specific as we could. Our favorite was always film noir. We always thought that was so fun. And we just really fine tuned that over years and years and years, just after the kids were in bed. And a lot of movies and TV shows have come out of that, creative projects, because of that group and that love of long form improvisation.
Wow. Well, you kind of like, just in passing, mentioned all these things. So let's go back a little bit and let's talk about, first of all, I think the first thing I really saw you in, and I'm trying to remember if it came before the Once I Was a Beehive movie, but the Chatbooks commercial.
Oh, yeah.
Was that before? Was that?
That was after.
Oh, okay.
Or kind of in between the two.
To me, that was where I was like, I was like, that was her. Oh my gosh, that was the best commercial ever. So talk a little bit about how that probably took off and you.
I had no idea it was going to go so viral. I remember auditioning for it and the audition said like overworked mom of like five, you know, of a lot of kids or something. And I was like, oh, I know this.
You're like, you raise your hand.
I have been studying for this role. In fact, I think I walked in and they were like, okay, so we're going to read this. And I said, listen. I'm already a fan of Chatbooks. I was already a customer because it's so great. You just send in, you know, your pictures. They make the book for you. You don't have to do anything. And I said, and I have five kids and I know this mom. I know this character. Like, just like
this is me.
This is my life. And I read the script and all these crazy things are happening that you wouldn't believe. And I'm like, these things have actually happened to me.
So. You're like, I'm a method actor. And I totally. This is long con right
this
here.
This is the only time I can really say that this role, I get it. And yeah, so I got the job and the rest, you know, sort of is history. I've become the Harmon Brothers produced it. And I've done a lot of stuff for them since then. And it was just the most fun thing to make. We were laughing so hard. And I remember some of it's improvised because they'd be like, oh, this line isn't working. What would you say? And I said, well, if this were real life, I would say, I'm so tired, you know, and they kept it in. And so we just would laugh and we had a great time on set. That was one of my favorite projects ever.
And it did go kind of crazy, right? I mean, like it was everywhere.
Yeah, so
it
funny.
It was huge. And did it win awards? I assume it won all kinds
these,
of awards.
Advertising awards. You know, I met the founders, Nate and Vanessa Quigley of Chatbooks, while I was in the bathtub. If you haven't seen the video, I'm fully clothed. I'm in a bathtub. And I like had to shoot it like 18 times, like in and out of the subs.
Bubbles.
And that's when I met Vanessa, which is so perfect. She comes over to me and she goes, I just want you to know, I'm the Chatbooks mom. I'm a mom of eight. I started this company, you know, like I'm crazy. I'm glad to meet you. And I said, no, I'm the Chatbooks mom. I've got, you know, these crazy kids. And we just kind of laughed. And we're actually like very dear friends to this day. So that was the whole vibe of that whole thing, which is kind of indicative of my career where I just want to laugh and have a good time and make funny stuff with my friends.
I'd love it. So talk a little bit about Once I Was a Beehive. That's one that kind of took off as well. I mean, it got really big and just kind of beloved, but also so much humor. Because I think sometimes that genre of maybe LDS-centric movies were, well, I mean.
You can say it. This is a safe place.
A little cheesy sometimes. Yeah. But this one was just, it had the humor. I guess to me, it's like, it's almost like. We're making fun of ourselves.
Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of great.
And which I think we should more. You know, I think that you need to tell your own stories about your own experiences. And so my very dear friends, McLean Nelson and Haley Smith, just my best friends. And we've done improv together. We started the Thrillionaires together. You know, McLean had grown up watching his mom be the, you know, stake and relief society. I'm not really study a young women's camp director, you know, and he's like, there's something about young women's camp that's so special. Tell me what it is. And so Haley and I like wrote all this stuff down and we talked about the ideas, and McLean's like, this is a movie that needs to be told, and we need to tell it, you know, because it's our people. So we know what to tease and what not, you know, it's done with love. Right. And so out of that came a great experience and movie about something that I feel really passionately about too. And I love the message. We wanted it to be very applicable to everyone. You know, and if you didn't grow up going to a girls' camp like that, but maybe you know what a church Bible camp is like, or maybe you just know what it's like to be an adolescent like that, or just to feel like you're the outsider, then we just thought everyone can relate to this movie. It's not just for girls. It's not just, you know, for people who are LDS. It's for everybody. And so we really were very conscious and intentional about making that accessible to everybody so that we can all come together and laugh. And I think we did a good, solid job of it.
You did a phenomenal job of it.
And it was a little indie movie, and it was funny stories came out of just making it, and it was really, really hard, and I'm so glad we did it.
Yeah, it's really a fun one. And for someone who has, I just tend to be in that youth group, that place. And I just was for a long time been involved in going to girls camp and planning girls camp and being
part of it.
That's
the worst too, isn't it? Because I hate camping.
Okay.
And so, I'm the young women's president in my ward right now. And I just got called like last year right before camp. And I showed up and my young women were like, all right, Carrie Carrington for camp. What are we going to do? And I was like, everyone's going to lower their expectations. That was a role. This is Lisa Clark is going to camp with you,
and she's not that fun.
And she is not fun like that.
She does not enjoy camping.
There's no arc that we're, you know, carrying. There's no snow cones on the top of the mountain hike.
Oh my gosh. I do have to say, like, my version, I think the most successful girls camp I ever had when I was a leader was we actually like left the state. I took the girls. I don't know if they would let me do this now, but I kind of just said I was doing it. I went to my sister's. We went to her place in Twin Falls.
Oh, how fun.
And we kayaked and we cliff jumped and we did all this really fun stuff. And I'm like, we'll get to the other stuff. It's fine. We'll make it all work.
They just need to be together, you know? And that's what we tried to do with the movie, too, is that it was like, yeah, we were teasing about like some of the funny things we do and say that are ridiculous. But like the heart of that movie is like they're not doing it, the leaders, to like manipulate the girls or to try to. They're just doing it because they love them, you know? And they're going to do it imperfectly because they just love the girls so much. Yeah. And I super relate. Related to that, of like, I know I'm weird and I know I'm a lot, but I just care.
But it's fun. I mean, like, those are the kinds of people that, and you hope, and again, I've talked on this podcast a ton about that one caring adult in your life.
Yes.
And I think it doesn't matter, like you say, it doesn't matter what faith tradition you belong to. Every youth needs someone that's not a parent.
Yep.
That's that one caring adult
that sees
something in them that people that they don't see in themselves.
And to be inclusive about that, you know, to say, like, I always tell the girls, you know, you don't have to pledge your allegiance to anyone or anything to be part of this group. Yeah. You know, no matter what you believe or you're thinking, you're in this neighborhood, you are welcome. You want to bring your friend, they are welcome. This is a place where you will be treated with kindness and respect and love and that you belong, and it's a safe place. There's no entry fee for that.
Yeah, I think that's such a great concept and such a great message for youth.
They need it now,
and
even more
saying,
than we,
like,
did when we were younger.
Truly, because you know what we're seeing is the anxiety and depression and social media use, and those two things are exponentially increasing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, so obviously there's a corollary there.
Oh, absolutely.
And
self-esteem, just, especially with teenage girls, and increased social media use is undeniable. And yeah, just to try to counteract that some way.
Yeah.
Feel really passionately about that.
So let's talk. I mean, we've talked a little bit. I told you before we started, like, I have a really hard time talking about being a mom, or I think we all have so many insecurities about being
for
a mom,
sure we do.
But you do a council of moms on your show, and it's phenomenal. What have you kind of learned through that process.
Oh, thanks. You know, on the Lisa Show podcast, that parenting and mothering is highlighted. It's not the only thing that we talk about it, but we do talk a lot about it. And we've done an episode on mom guilt or trying to, you know, relax when you're super stressed or, you know, different sort of parenting techniques. And so we do this segment called Council of Moms, where I get everyday regular moms, and I say that because they're secretly, like most moms, rock stars, right? Like, yeah. They know, they've lived it, to come into a room and we talk about things. We really, really talk about things. And the things that I've learned is that we're all making it up as we go. The stakes are high and we all feel it. We all feel a lot of pressure and we're all really hard on ourselves when we don't need to be, because we would never be that hard to each other. And so getting a group of women to talk about things like, how do you really feel? Like, what is it really like in your home? And what do you think about and worry about and struggle with? I find that once we talk about it, it becomes less overwhelming, less scary. There's a lot more empathy for ourselves because we have more empathy for others. And then it makes us feel like, oh no, we're doing it. We're doing a better job than we think we can. And I feel like coming together and even just listening to other moms like be really real about it helps you feel a little bit more empowered to just go, oh, yeah, this is a really important thing. But it also is one aspect of who I am and I can only do what I can do. And, you know, we try to give you a lot of ideas and talk about that. But just like in any conversation, not everything's going to be for everybody, right? But you are smart enough to be able to figure out what you need to do or pluck out. But it's just to help us all feel a little bit less alone in that, because I think it is very isolating, especially as your kids get older and their problems and the parenting questions and situations get more serious. It's not as fun to talk about as it was when they were little, like, oh, well, what kind of formula do you use? Or what about daycare? Or what do you think about this, you know, first grade teacher? You know, that we can talk about everything when they're little. Once they start getting to be about 11, 12, 13, then we all go into our little corners. And I just think that's when we need each other the most. That's when we need to pull back the curtain and go, no, seriously, I'm really, really worried about my kid's depression, or they won't go to school. What do I do? Like, you know, or I, you know, they're doing drugs, or they're on social media too much, or they have an eating disorder, like serious things. Like, what do you do and who do you talk to? It has to be a safe place. And I'm surprised by and alarmed by how many parents don't have that safe place. They need the support, too, so that they can be there for their kids.
Yeah, I think, too, even as parents, we talk about kids on social media, parents, moms on social media, you know, you're only seeing like the fabulous vacations and the, you know, your kids getting a major award or whatever it is. Right. But the real life,
everyone went to spring break.
Yeah.
And if you're the idiot like me, who never goes any, we didn't grow up going on spring break somewhere. No, it's almost summer. No, but you see that and you feel it, right? It creates this new thing that's not even real.
Yeah. No, it's so true. I actually had my sister text me, one of my sisters texted me the other night, and she's just at her wit's end with her son, and she was just really struggling. And she was texting me because I have three boys, and she was saying, why didn't you warn me about 15-year-old boys? And I was like, and then I felt terrible because
you can't.
But it's like nursing. She's like, it's like nursing. Nobody told me it was horrible. You just see, oh, mom's just nurse. It's a thing they do. And you're like, but wait a minute. And so you're like, oh, you just look and people look like they're just doing teenage boys and they're just very successful. And you're like, what is happening with me? Yeah. And why am I failing? And so I love having those conversations, those real conversations. Let's not do Instagram world.
No,
let's do like real live world.
And that's what we really try to do on the Lisa Show.
I love that. That's so perfect. And we want to keep talking about that when we come right back. We're back here with Lisa Clark on First Lady and Friends. This is just such an honor for me to be here with you. You're the pro. You're
so
amazing.
Nice. I don't know about that, but
you are. And it's been fun to talk about momming. So let's kind of continue on that theme. We were talking a little bit in the break about adult parenting. So nobody warns you.
It's the worst.
About adult parent, like adult children.
They can't, because if they did, no one would want to parent. Yeah.
It's like nursing. It's like everything else. It's like, it's going to be a dirty little secret.
Well, also, you can't describe it either. I remember once my mom saying, you never stop being a mom. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And she's like, remember when you went off to college and you were crying because you were leaving your boyfriend behind? I was crying because I'm leaving my child behind. And I didn't even think twice about my parents when they dropped me off at college. And I think about it now, having done that for three kids. And I think, I was so dumb. But that's just the deal in parenting. You know, the stakes are high and you love so much and you never stop caring.
Yeah, there's this, and I'm sorry if you are a parent of kids that are small right now and you have this mistaken notion, you know, that 18 that somebody said, oh, from 18,
it's okay.
Like, it's okay. But really, no. The thing about adult parenting is, you know, parenting adult children is that the mistakes they make, you know, as an 8-year-old is like they rip their pants or, you know, at school or they do something stupid.
Forget to hand in a paper.
Yeah. They, you know, and the teacher calls you because they were playing some stupid game at school that we won't mention, Gavin. So, but now you're talking like life decisions, like decisions that are affecting like their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And their frontal lobes are still not completely developed. So it's really hard.
Yeah, it's tricky. And they have all the power, too, because it's their lives, as they should, right?
Yeah.
They can be tried as adults. They can... No, but really.
Just remember that, kids.
Well, and also, I don't you remember being that age, too, and thinking, oh, yeah, well, I'll try this and do this and that and whatever. But you don't realize that the decisions that you make in your early 20s really put you on a path in life that, you know, yes, you can change. Yes, you can, you know, change your mind. I'm not saying that, but I am saying that it is a bigger deal, I think, than even I thought at that time. And so now you see your kids do it and you just want to say, hey, learn from me. Hey, you know, fun fact, I love you and I know you probably better than anyone else. And I'd like to give you some advice. And for them to look at you and go, no, thanks. I'd just like to learn on my own, please. And it's just like, wow. Oof. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And when your kids are little, you have, I know people with little kids don't maybe feel this so much, but you really do have a lot of control.
Yeah. You get to decide what you buy, what they eat, kind of what they wear and who they're with, and you know where they are and what time they go to bed and what their habits are. And then you don't know any of those things.
Which, again, is good. I mean, for me, there's this balance of, this is this thing I've struggled with adult children, is there's a balance of, first of all, they're not totally financially independent, but they want to be independent in every other way. Yeah. And so I'm like, no, I do still have a little control because I am still paying for a few things.
Yeah, so those boundaries that are always changing, and actually preparing a podcast on this, on the Lisa Show, just about this very thing, about how you like renegotiate those boundaries and renegotiate parenting so that everybody feels like loved and respected. And how can you have those really difficult conversations with less conflict, right? Mm-hmm. To say, this is what I need to feel good about this situation. What do you need to feel good? And to be able to be flexible like that with that changing relationship takes a lot of, it's not something, it takes a lot of trust and it takes a lot of love. And it's not something that comes naturally to anybody. It's something that we both have to practice. So it's hard because you have to practice it as a parent and then they have to practice it as a baby adult. And, you know, you come together and have these conversations, hopefully with love and respect, but sometimes it can be with frustration and tears you know.
I'm gonna try really hard with the love and respect thing. That's where I need to work
on. Yeah, but just negotiating those relationships. Yeah.
That's incredible advice, and I can't wait to hear the show because that's where I'm at
it's
right
about
now.
About boundaries, yeah.
I'm ready for boundaries.
Me too.
Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit. We mentioned your dear husband. Let's talk a little bit about your experience. He had a pretty severe, debilitating illness, ALS.
Yeah, the worst disease. I dare you to find a worse, more cruel disease.
Yeah, I've known a few people that have had that. And just talk a little bit about your journey and you know, from diagnosis and you know, what it meant for your family and oh, then, sure. you know, kind of beyond that.
I mean, it's a really long story, but the medium version of it is that, you know, he always was really healthy and vivacious, like just always moving around, a great theater director, actor, husband, father, friend, just moving and shaking all the time, and just has done wonderful things at Utah Valley University. They're honoring him with a scholarship in his name for the London Study Abroad program that he started. The Green Room is named after him. Mm-hmm. There's a cool, like, a bust of his head there that he wants the actors to rub.
That was so great.
His bald head before they go on stage.
I love it.
Like, that's just who he is. Just funny, and was diagnosed very unexpectedly with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, in 2016. Lived with it for 4.5 years before he passed away June 5th of 2020. You know, during a global pandemic when we couldn't see any friends or have anybody over to help me take care of him. And it was just the absolute worst. But I will say that, like, my kids are incredible. And they're a lot like their father, thank goodness. And they live life and they don't feel guilty about that, about being happy and moving forward, because they're very confident that that's how their dad wanted them to live. And that was just such a huge gift that he gave us. And I love to honor him. I can't believe it's been almost 2 years since it's his passing. He passed away 2 days after we celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. He had this big surprise planned for me. I mean, he was just an incredible person.
Wow.
Yeah. And his legacy lives on, and I'm just so grateful for the time that we were able to have.
Yeah, so that, tell me a little bit, so your kids are kind of, what was it like, that moment of diagnosis when you get that?
Oh, it was such a shock. Yeah. We couldn't even talk about it to each other for about 2 weeks. We looked at each other. Like, it took about 3 months to diagnose. And in that time, we were like, is it a brain tumor? Is it cancer? Is it leukemia? Is it MS? And like, it's so interesting, like, to pray, oh, I hope it's a brain tumor, because at least you can operate. At least there's a chance. But if it's this one thing that no one is saying out loud, it can't be that. And of course, I Google it, WebMD. My brother, the doctor, was like, don't do
that.
We're
all dying.
But of course, yeah. I Google his symptoms, and that's what pops up. And I was like, it can't be that. And so when it was that, it was just devastating. Our oldest was 18 and our youngest was 8. We told them only our 18-year-old really understood what that meant. We told our families, and we started telling close friends, and it was the worst to tell they were like, you're kidding. Like, because our friends were all real jokey, and we're like, this is not a joke. Like, we are for sure. It was awful. And that first year was really hard, just trying to learn new languages and learn, like, well, what can we do? And we're going to fight this, and we're going to be the, you know. No one has found a treatment or a cure for it, but maybe I can. Because I don't know if you guys know, I'm really good at researching. And I just, like, but you live in that weird space. And then I remember about the first year in thinking, no, this is how he dies. And now it should be my focus to make him comfortable, to make the time that he has fun so that he can teach as long as he wants, so that we can still travel as long as he wants, you know, and keep things as quote unquote normal as we possibly can. And I feel really grateful that we were able to do that with the help of friends and family. We were able to have so many great days and so many happy, happy, happy moments. And it wasn't all doom and gloom. Mm. And he made fun of himself, and he made fun of every time he lost the ability to do something. He would joke about it or make a video about it. You know, he had this, like, ALS voice when his voice was going, and it kind of sounded like Frankenstein. So he had his friends who were, like, makeup artists come and dress him up as Frankenstein, and then his cousin, and they did this, like, black and white putting on the Ritz, like, video where he was the young Frankenstein, and he would just try to sing, but he couldn't sing because he couldn't carry a note because his voice was going, and he just sounded like Frankenstein. And it is the funniest thing that you've ever seen. And people would comment on his Facebook or on his, you know, Instagram or whatever, and be like, I don't know if I can laugh at this. And he's like, this is why I did it. Of course you can laugh about it. And he gave, like,
permission,
the cue to everyone else of, like, no, this is so stupid. Let's just laugh about it. Yeah. You know, he had that Stephen Hawking setup, you know, with the screen where you'd, like, type with your eyes when his voice went. Yeah. And it had these, like, texted things in it, like, and they were so depressing, and Chris would laugh at him so hard. So we would be in the middle of Target or something, and he'd be standing with one of my sons or something, and he would press the button, and it would say, "Help, I don't know this person." And he would just press it over and over again, crying because he was laughing so hard. And my son would be like, Dad, stop, don't do that. Like, or, you know, he would press it and it would say, "No one knows how this feels." And then he would just laugh, and just like he would just use anything in there just to laugh and joke. And he set the tone for our family. And I realize now, especially even more and more, like what a gift that was, yeah. You know, he, you know, thought, I've got 10 minutes a day to feel sorry for myself, you know, you talk about going on social media and just seeing people who just, you know, didn't have to think about all the things that he had to think about as he slowly lost control of all of his muscles, couldn't speak, couldn't move by the end, you know, and that last year of his life. And he just made the best of it. You know, here then we had so many people helping him, physical therapists and nurses and stuff coming in and out. And then the pandemic hit and everybody had to go home. And I looked at my oldest son, Miles, and I said, "It's just you and me taking care of this grown man." I mean, lifting him up, helping him. I mean, he couldn't even scratch his nose by himself. Mm-hmm. And I said, "I'm so sorry. I didn't want this for you." And Miles, just like his dad, just said, "You know, this is my dad. What else is more important?" Yeah. And so I would take 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. and he would take 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. And I would wake up at 4 and go to my job and do my early morning show and then come back. And I think about that now, you know, and we, you know, we compare our lives to other people and on social media, boy, I was losing big time.
Yeah.
And yet we laughed. We had fun. We were a family. I wish I were living that life now, you know?
Yeah.
So it gave my kids a different perspective that they'll, you know, whether we wanted that for them or not, that they will never forget. And when I have a hard time, which I do, you know, I miss him. Yeah. I let myself have 10 minutes of feeling sorry for myself. And then I just think, what would Chris do? Chris would get up and go to work and make somebody laugh. He'd do something. He'd keep moving forward. So that's what we're all trying to do.
Well, and it's kind of a privilege. I remember when my grandpa was really sick with cancer, and I remember a lot of the other family members. We lived really close, and I remember taking care of him. And my grandma, if she'd have to, you know, and she was old too, so we would go over there and help take care of him. And I remember thinking, what a privilege. I just didn't, nobody else got that. And I think that's what you're talking about, just
for sure.
Almost a privilege.
That's how I see it.
To have somebody who did so much for you and meant so much to you, yeah. You get the honor of sort of taking care of them and helping them transition.
Yeah.
To the next life.
And I had always promised him, because, you know, you have to make a lot of decisions ahead of time with a disease like ALS. And he was very clear about what he wanted and what he didn't want, which is a gift, you know, and he had everything planned out and the funeral and all that.
And say, I hope the funeral was a lot of fun and music and
yeah, right.
Did he plan a fun?
Well, and we had to keep the numbers low. It could only be immediate family. It was during a global pandemic.
Oh my
it
gosh,
was I... not how he had envisioned it.
No.
And in fact, I joked with him. I was like, "Well, you can't die now during a pandemic because
yeah,
you can't have this huge, you know, celebration of your life." And he was like, "Oh, I'm done with that. You know, like it's all right. It can just be a religious ceremony." And I've been able to tell the people who I love, you know, goodbye, and I'm done with this goodbye tour. And I just had made a promise to him that I wouldn't let him suffer. And so when it got to that point, he made it better for all of us, you know, and yeah, you just don't forget that. It kind of changes you forever.
Yeah.
I'm a lot of fun at parties.
I know.
Let me tell you. Do you have your own headstone? I do. Should we talk about it? No? Okay, cool. I'll just get some chips. I'll be over here.
So,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, at least. Okay. So in Fairview, and maybe it's everywhere, and I just don't know it because I don't spend a lot of time in cemeteries. But
well, you're missing out. Let me tell you. I'll show you around. Don't worry.
But there are I know couples in our town that literally they're both still alive and they put their headstone up.
It's already there.
Yes.
Well, have them at least hold it at the quarry or whatever, and don't put it in until you have to.
No, they were It was like there.
Okay, I've never heard of that. That's weird.
I walked past and I'm looking at it and I'm like, they're not dead.
They're alive. That's
and so they just have their birth.
Yeah,
year, yeah. Your their birth dates.
But you can't engrave the birthday first because you don't know when you're going to die, and it has to be symmetrical. See, these are things that I know that I wish I didn't know.
Yes,
but I know them. Don't. Okay, here's the deal.
I'll have
get
to go
one
back
if you need to, but if you don't need to, don't get a headstone.
Yeah, no.
That's
buy a plot
opinion.
If you want.
Buy a plot. In fact, now I'm like, you guys, I know where I'm buried, so I'm asking all my friends and family, like, just reserve the plot around us because it's going.
It's,
I can see people are buying them up.
It's going to be a
this
party.
This is a hot commodity right now. And they look at me like, no, we're not doing that.
I can't remember if it was when Spencer was the mayor. They're like, it was like a 2-for-1 deal at the cemetery. And I was, Spencer,
2-for-1 deal.
He was trying to talk me into it. Oh. And I was like, no, I am not buying a plot right now.
Until you have
but
to.
In hindsight, I'm kind of wishing we would.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's so funny talking to my parents or, you know, someone who's like, you know, in their 80s or something, like, you should think about this. And they're like, no way. And I just like, man, I'm in my 40s and I've had to think about it.
Yeah.
Life is weird.
And really unpredictable, but we celebrate and we celebrate through laughter.
Yes,
and I love
absolutely.
that's what you've done. And I love that you're bringing joy to so many people. Tell us maybe what's next for you.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I love doing the Lisa Show on BYU Radio, and you can download the podcast wherever. I really, really like it. It has so much more meaning to me because now I just feel like it's so needed. There's so much pressure on the end. I just want to create a place where people can come and they feel like they connect. They feel like they belong and they feel like it's going to encourage them, you know, a little bit and not be like, oh, what's one more thing I need to be doing? Yeah. So I do love that. I still love performing improv with my friends when I can. I want to make some more indie movies with them. I'd love to do another season of Show Offs on BYU TV. And we only did 3 seasons. I'd love to do it. It's a little bit more of like improv like that. I'd love to do some more writing. You know, my kids are getting older and they're going to go off into the world and
be very successful adults as
and
we've
be very
established.
Successful adults. So
that's the goal.
Looking forward to watching them fly.
We want them to fly and not fall. So, thank you, Lisa. This has been just really a fun time for me. And again, you're an expert in this, and we want our listeners to go and download your podcast, the Lisa Show podcast, wherever you find your podcasts. It's phenomenal. I've been listening to them and very uplifting. And it's something that we definitely need in this world. Like you talked about, we need connection.
We need it.
We need to come together as a community and we need to just lift each other up. I don't understand people going through the world angry and upset about everything because it's just not fun for me. So I feel like if you're lifting each other up, being kind, let's just move forward together and have a laugh. Be an amazing community and let's have a laugh. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can learn more about the Lisa Show at byuradio.org/Lisa. And you can find the Lisa Show on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for being a friend.